I'm Bob Carlson, and this is KCRW Selects, some of the best parts from KCRW podcasts. Summer is the perfect time to discover new podcasts. Maybe you're on a road trip, you're at the beach, you got time on your hands. Well, on this program, we'll highlight episodes from KCRW's slate of award-winning podcast programs, and maybe you'll find some favorites. This week, we'll listen to the latest episode from the weekly podcast, To the Point. Warren Olney, of course, is well known to KCRW radio listeners as a veteran TV and radio journalist who makes sense of complicated issues through fair and accurate reporting and interviews with newsmakers, experts, and journalists. And much of the time, this has been a fast-breaking kind of news analysis. But now on the To the Point podcast, he's doing something different.
To the Point is a chance for me, instead of just talking about the news of the day in a very superficial way and moving from one subject to the next, to actually go deep into a particular story. For example, the fact that we have criminalized mental illness and that we now put people who are mentally ill in jails and prisons instead of treating them like the sick people that they are.
So right now on KCRW Selects, we'll listen to the most recent episode of the To the Point podcast. Warren speaks to a sheriff who's running a mental hospital in one of America's biggest county jails, an author who examines the history of our built-in fear of the mentally ill, and Warren Olney talks to a prisoner currently serving time.
In this week's podcast, we had a chance to talk to John Lennon, who is an inmate. He is serving time for murder in the Sing Sing Correctional Facility in New York. He's also written a magazine article for Esquire called This Place is Crazy. Here he is.
I guess it just dawned on me when I just saw this guy in front of me, and I'm at the table with these guys, with the rest of sort of knock-around guys in a prison yard. I was at Attica at the time, so I saw this guy. I mean, he's just shuffling, picking up cigarette butts in the yard, and this is like a pretty wild yard. And I just thought out loud. I was sitting there next to the guy, just gazing at this guy, and I was just like, look at the shape of this guy. Like, what's his story? And so I call him over, and he tells me his story. And it was just really in that moment that that I knew I would write about him.
What did he tell you? What's his story, and how does it resemble the stories of other people who are also mentally ill in prison?
Well, his story did resemble many people, you know, especially in New York, but I'm sure Alyssa Roth can speak to this on a national level. But in New York, here in New York, most of the treatment sort of programs are in maximum security prisons. So this guy, Joe, for example, was serving 2 years. And most of, you know, the guys at the table with me, my cronies, many of which are convicted murderers, like myself, and we've got, like, heavy time in, heavy time to go, and this guy's shuffling around with a 2-year sentence for walking into a smoker's choice in Oneonta, New York, with a BB gun. And basically, he pulled it out, and, had, you know, he was on Klonopin, he was having a hard time with his medication, and hanging on by a thread. And the store clerk, which is a woman, she looked at him and said, get out of here. And when he told me that, my friends and I basically burst out laughing because it was this sort of like, it was kind of a joke, and not to sound glib, but like, I'm taking you into a prison yard, you know? So, I mean, it was just like, you know, it was that kind of deal. So he was sent there for treatment, but turns out he didn't even get to go into the program that Attica had set up for several months, which means he was sort of stumbling around in the prison population with the rest of us before he got placed in that particular program. And that happens all over the country.
You work on a unit that deals with people who are mentally ill. Do they get worse as a result in being in prison, or do they get better?
I mean, it depends on the individual. I mean, I can't sit here and say that there isn't treatment going on in prison. I mean, I think people really work their, you know, try their damnedest with the resources they have. Some of the OMH counselors that I work with every day, they really, really try. They're sort of spread thin. They have to. I work on a unit for seriously mentally ill men with a tendency for violence. So, you know, I'm sometimes I got my back to the wall in case a guy wants to just just hook off on you. So it's quite a scene up there sometimes. But at the same time, it's not all the men are violent, and it happens on occasion. The point is, there has to be treatment. There's treatment in a prison setting, and I think the mental health workers do the best that they can in a prison setting. There's always this conflict, though, with the officers, and not that the officers are doing anything. They're just doing what they thought that they signed up for, which was to just be correctional officers. They didn't think they were going to sign up to be doctors and to be psych nurses and to be et cetera. But that's really what they have to do a lot of the time. So there's this conflict. And actually, Alyssa Roth lays that out extensively in her book.
We're going to be talking with her in a minute. Before we go any further, we've referred a couple of times to your murder conviction. I think our listeners probably want to know, and if you're willing to tell us how you came to have that.
Yeah, I mean, I was engaged in a lifestyle of selling drugs, and it was a pretty disgusting scene. I was at 23 years old. I was pretty much the lifestyle I was living had reached a head. I found out a man that I was associated with was sort of extorting the drug dealer that had worked for me, and I had wound up shooting and killing him. And for that, I am sorry, and I went away for that. I mean, it's interesting you asked that. I mean, because, you know, when you think about guys like me and then guys like Joe, for example, or other guys like, so when I say guys like me, I said, so I'm culpable, right? So I'm guilty. I committed this murder. And frankly, I'm where I need to be, right? I mean, whether I should get out or not, I think that's a whole other conversation. That's not what this is about.
Sure.
But I'm culpable, right? And then you have like, so you're asking this question, are guys in the right place that are getting treated? So there's this big case that everybody knows about. There's this Andrew Goldstein, right? Guy that pushed Kendra Webdale in front of the subway in 1999. After that, Kendra's law followed. He was off his medication. He was a schizophrenic, and he wound up pushing this woman he did not even know just in front of a train. The criminal justice system said it was because he was rejected by women, and this is what he did. He pushed her in front of the train. They were out for blood. They wanted to punish him. So he goes before trial, and he gets convicted to 25 to life. Turns out his case gets overturned, and then he gets a 20 flat sentence. So he's gonna get out, I guess. But he's been treated in prison. He's been in prison for 19 years. I guess the first question is, is he dangerous? Is he getting out? I think I don't know if that's the question. Why did we want him to go to prison to begin with? Like why was he sent to prison to be treated for something? He's clearly schizophrenic. He clearly had these issues. So I'm juxtaposing my culpability to his, is I guess the point I'm trying to make.
You've introduced Alyssa Roth already a couple of times, and I want to get her in. And don't go away, John Lennon, if you lose us. Call us back. Once again, speaking to us from the Sing Sing Correctional Facility. Now, John Lennon has written an article called This Place is Crazy. Alyssa Roth is a journalist and author of a book called Insane. The subtitle, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. So, you've taken a look at the history of all of this, going back not just to Dorothea Dix, but before that.
That's right. We can go back to before we were ever a country, to the mid-1700s. Benjamin Franklin was talking about the question of where should people with mental illness live, the problem that people with mental illness were ending up in jail in colonial Philadelphia because we had no place else for them to live safely. Interestingly, he talked about the fear that people living in Philadelphia in Pennsylvania had of these people with mental illness, and I think that's a big part of this discussion. John talked about the Kendra Webdale case, this anxiety, this fear that we have as a society of what people with mental illness might or might not do. And I think that in part has led us to think it's okay to have people with mental illness be kept in jail or prison.
Very quickly, John said that some of the people he works with are violent, but mentally ill people, generally speaking, are not necessarily, are they?
That's right. It's a very, very small percentage of people with mental illness who are violent. Studies show that people with mental illness are far more likely to be victims than aggressors. And that's true whether they're living in the community or whether they're living in jail or prison, but we have this perception that really pervades every step of the criminal justice system, whether it's the police officer who arrests somebody or the judge who sets bail.
So we've gone back then to colonial days after having mental hospitals as a result of Dorothea Dix. And that all began roughly in the middle of the last century. It started in part in California when Ronald Reagan was governor. And it was determined that mental hospitals were snake pits. They were being run by the state. They were terrible places. And it was agreed by liberals as well as conservatives that they ought to be shut down. What happened?
I mean, there's no question that that many of these state hospitals were in terrible shape. We think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which did a beautiful job of portraying the deterioration of the hospital. I think it's important to note that even at the height of institutionalization in the mid-1950s, there were still a lot of people with mental illness who were living in the communities. So we like to draw this very clear line from shutting the institutions, whether in the 50s and 60s or later under Reagan in California, to the crisis that we're in now. But the truth is that we've always had people with mental illness who were living in the community, and we've always had people with mental illness who ended up in jail or prison.
So at what point did the prisons begin to really fill up, as John describes it, with mentally ill people? How many mentally ill people, what percentage of them are in prisons? What percentage of the prison population is mentally ill?
Roughly half of the people in jails and prisons in this country have a mental illness. Depending where you look and how you're defining mental illness, the numbers vary somewhat. But I argue that this crisis that we're in right now is really part of this larger story of mass incarceration. So it's a continuum of our history of locking people with mental illness in jail and prison, but where we've really seen this explosion in the population came with the explosion in our incarcerated population. So we have 2.2 million ish people who are locked up in this country. And we really saw that growth as the jail and prison population grew, so did the population of people with mental illness there.
Lisa Roth, again, her book, Insane. Tom Dart is with us. He's running one of America's largest mental health institutions right now. It may even be the largest mental health institution in the United States in the context that we're talking about it here. His job title, Sheriff of Cook County, Illinois. Sheriff Dart, thanks a lot for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Is this an appropriate thing for people who have been trained as law enforcement officers, such as yourself, to be spending so much of their time now, so much of their efforts, so much of their resources on people who are mentally ill?
You know, John said it a few moments ago. I can't tell you of any law enforcement professionals, correctional officers, any of the rest of them who signed up for that job with the notion that they're becoming mental health professionals. Nobody did. And society has also said the exact same thing. That, you know, here's the police officer, here's what your function is, correctional officer, this is your function. So clearly, as a society, we've taken this segment of our population, the mentally ill. We've decided we don't want to deal with the issue. We don't want to address it. So where can we hide these folks where they're out of our way and they're not on our streets and they're not bothering society? And let's see, the jails and prisons. And you think about it. I used to be a legislator. I used to be a prosecutor as well. This has been going on, as Lisa had said, this has been going on for the longest time. And it's probably, as she mentioned before, and I read in her book. Her book's fantastic. It really lays it all out there. This has been going on for a while, but it's more gone on steroids lately with the number of people that have been pouring into jails and prisons. And I don't know if it was something that was only us on the inside that fully could get our arms around this, but you couldn't walk into a jail or prison anywhere and not realize that the large percentage of the people in there are suffering from this serious mental illness. And you also can't help but realize that you couldn't think of a more inappropriate place to put them if you had laid all the options on the table. This would be the worst one, both from a human standpoint, but also from a fiscal standpoint. And yet that is what we're doing. So how do you explain it then? You explain it is that we're just trying to push a problem that we don't want to deal with, push it off the table, and jails and prisons don't have any option. They can't say no.
Remind our listeners, we're talking with the sheriff of Cook County, Illinois, who has to deal with this issue on a daily basis. So we've criminalized mental illness, it seems to me, and probably have been doing that for a long, long time. How does it work? How do people who are mentally ill find their way, or how is it that they are put in prison? What's the process that takes place?
You know what? It's the most, if you think about it, it's the most logical thing in the world. And that's why I defy people who sit there and say that this is some type of benign act by government. It's not. It's very logical. Most people suffering from mental illness, when it says the onset of it is, that obviously differs. But what more often than not happens is they are unable to hold down a job if they are not properly addressing their mental illness. They can't properly address it if we're not funding mental health services in the community, which we've been eviscerating throughout this country forever. And so they start deteriorating. They lose their jobs. Okay, so then they lose their housing. They're back with their families. Frequently, we get story after story. They're back home with their families. The families can handle it for a short period of time, and then they can't any longer. So we get loads and loads of calls on the police side of the sheriff's office for domestic issues at houses where someone's suffering from mental illness. They're put out of the house. There's orders of protections to keep them out of the house. So where do these people go then? Well, they don't have any money. They don't have a place to live. They go to the streets. And after a period of time on the street, they're trying to survive. They're trying to find food and shelter. So what is the most routine charges we see against them are theft of minor things, sometimes to feed themselves, sometimes just stealing for no real good reason. But more often than not, it's criminal trespass to property, meaning they're trying to find a place to sleep, usually in bus stations and at the airports. Then they get taken into custody by a local law enforcement agency, brought to the criminal courtroom, where bonds frequently were set. The bonds were set very low, but these were homeless people. They couldn't come up with, you know, $1,000. They can't come up with $10. So they would sit and sit and sit in the jail. And then to further exacerbate this, the court would then have them in front of them and say, well, you know what, this person I don't believe is fit to stand trial, so let's send them out for a fitness hearing, which of course will take a couple months. And then at the conclusion of that, they say the person's not fit, let's send them to a mental health hospital to make them fit for trial. And then by the time they come back for that, they have clearly exceeded any amount of time they could have gotten for the most maximum penalty. But in the interim, they're sitting in a jail cell. And think about this for a second, Warren. Can you think of any thoughtful psychologist, psychiatrist, take your pick, whose course of treatment that they would prescribe would be, we're going to put you in a 4x8 concrete room by yourself, or maybe with someone with a completely different issue, for an indeterminate period of time, and we're going to have people who signed up to be correctional officers be the ones watching you? Nobody would do that. And then you jettison them out to the street at all hours of the night and expect everything to be good. This is not only inhumane and thoughtless, but it is the most fiscally inefficient system you could have designed.
Tom Dart, the sheriff of Cook County, Illinois. I want to go back to John Lennon, who is the inmate in the Sing Sing Correctional Facility, talking with us, who works with people there who have a mental illness and mental problems. Is there any question that this process makes people much worse? It makes their illness much worse than it was when they started out?
Well, everyone has a different experience. I was talking about Andrew Goldstein before. I mean, I sure wish he was sent to a hospital. He told me that some of the psychiatrists tell him that, too. He should have been in a hospital to begin with. And then now, 19 years later, after you punished him, you want him to go to a hospital. Here's what prison looked like for Andrew Goldstein for 19 years. He's usually been on units with other guys that have personality disorders, maybe some gang members. They have a little bit of ADD, a little bipolar, so he can't really manage his money well. So he has burnt fingertips because he can't stop smoking cigarettes. So he'll take one cigarette and he has to pay back five cigarettes to the other guys on the unit who could sort of manage their stuff well. So he's been living like that. And when he can't do that and the money runs out there, he'll go to the mess hall and he'll sell his hot dog for a cigarette later, so he'll starve. So this is what punishment looks like for a fellow with schizophrenia.
Okay. So, now, Elisa Roth, back to you. What is the record when people of this nature do get out, in fact, when the sentence is over, when they're finally released?
I mean, people with mental illness fare worse in almost every aspect of the criminal justice system. So whether it's not getting bail or taking longer for them to be able to make bail, longer sentences. And then when they get to the end, they're less likely to make parole and they're more likely to come back again. And when you look at cities like New York and LA and Chicago, the people who come back to jail over and over and over again, a very large percentage have a mental illness. So the track record for people with mental illness in the criminal justice system is not very good.
So, Sheriff Dart, back to you. You said earlier that the programs for dealing with this have been eviscerated. What are the programs that have been destroyed, and would we be better off if we reinstituted them?
You know, Warren, about 5 years ago now, I lose track of time here. Our state is so dysfunctional as it is, so we have surgically been reducing the funding for mental health providers over the course of the last decade. But about 5 years ago, the city of Chicago, for absolutely no good reason, there was no study, there was no analysis, they eliminated 6 of their 12 mental health clinics that they had sprinkled throughout the city. Many of them, most of them, in the very zip codes where most of the people leaving the jail go to, because we track everybody. Because I told people, hey, listen, if you're going to make me be a mental health hospital, I'm going to be the best mental health hospital that you have. And so we treat people like patients. When they come into our custody, we have mental health professionals meet them at the door, and then we walk them through the system. We have them in different settings. We have therapeutic classes for them. I've moved them off the compound into somewhat of a bucolic setting of Quonset huts, and then we work with them to leave. We go through 8 hours a day with classes running the gamut with psychologists for them, and then we case manage them out the door, literally out the door. And literally, I use my vehicles to drive them home. I either drive them home, I drive them to hospitals, wherever they need to go. My only point, though, is that after they leave me, our data shows that when they're leaving me for the first month or two, they're doing very, very well, not reoffending and actually making their appointments. It's after they get pushed out further from the first like 2 months that the results aren't as good. Why? Because I don't have any services that I can connect them with. I signed them up for the Affordable Care Act. I've signed up like 25,000 people to date so far at intake for that. But the reality of it is there's no providers that I can steer them to because they can't afford to exist in our state anymore. So these are things that have been laid out by many, many very smart, dedicated people. There's ways to do this that are not ridiculously expensive. But when you remove the safety net for these people, it's what Alisa just said. It's just they're doomed for failure. They're doomed for failure. The highest percentage will keep coming back because we know they have these issues, but yet we insist on not providing them that. But we've noticed clearly when we have started our case management program here and staying with people, the success has been astronomical compared to what we had before.
So what about the relative cost, then, of the kinds of programs that you say are now being shutting down in Chicago? A 6 of 12 settings have been eliminated altogether, those that are outside the jail system. What's the relative cost of those compared to what it costs you to do all that you're doing?
You know, none of that, that's why I keep telling people, I go, listen, there is no economist, there's no financial expert who would look at this data and not say the system that the criminal justice system is using throughout the country is the least cost-effective system you can imagine. I mean, this isn't like up for debate. There's no debate. This isn't as if I'm trying to debate with you, Warren, right now about System A as opposed to System B. No, it's System A, my system, as opposed to no system, where it's literally, and you think about it too, Warren, jails, you know, as opposed to prisons, jails are supposed to be these short-term holding cells for people waiting for trials. And so, by and large, sheriffs have always been sort of led to believe you're really not supposed to be much into this case management model that I do because you're not supposed to have people there that long, and they're supposed to be back off into their world. Well, jails changed a long time ago. I have 3 people in my custody today who have been waiting for their trial for 10 years. So,
whoa.
Yeah, so you need to have changed with the time.
10 years, excuse me.
Yeah, so don't get me started. The judiciary and myself do not get along very well in this county because I have been very vocal in how cases get disposed of here. But the reality of it is that there has to be this change of the mindset of the people operating the criminal justice system, such as sheriffs, to understand that we now need to be different than what we had been asked to be. We need to be more engaged with reintegrating people into communities, not just releasing them. And I would get pushback from attorneys at times saying, well, you know, you can't hold people an extra hour or 2 hours, Tom, after they've been told to be released. And I said, well, no, if we don't do that, we don't plan for their release, we're setting them up to fail. They're literally leaving us at 11 o'clock at night. It's snowing out. and they have a mental illness that we've been working with them on, and now we're going to put them out in the street? How is this going to work? But that is what my point is, Warren. It isn't a choice between two valid, philosophically maybe different systems. It's a choice between having a system or having nothing, which is the majority of the jurisdictions around the country.
Lisa Roth, let me go back to you. Sheriff Dart believes he has the biggest of the new mental institutions that we're talking about. The sheriff of Los Angeles County says the same thing. Are there other sheriffs that are taking the same kind of approach to this that Sheriff Dart is and actually trying to be, as he put it, the best of a bad situation?
One of the positive things about what I found in researching this book is that almost everybody seems to agree, or I'd say even everybody agrees, that what we're doing right now is wrong and that it's not working. And the question is, how do we find a way that does work? And so certainly what we're seeing in Sheriff Dart jail is very exciting. LA County has been trying different tactics. New York, which is the third part of the triumvirate of the biggest three jails in the country, has taken a different approach. They've built very involved behavioral health units in the jail that are meant to mimic the kinds of behavioral health units we see on the outside. So everybody is looking at this and saying, how can we possibly fix this? But part of the problem is that it's not just the jails. The jail is one little slice of this. So what you're seeing at the state prison level are different issues and different ways of managing them. And what you're seeing before people end up in jail or while they're in jail on the court side of things is a whole other set of problems. And so while we should absolutely be doing things to make jail better and to make the transition out of jail better, we also have to be thinking about those interactions with law enforcement. We have to be thinking about what's happening in court or in those, the decision to send somebody to be restored to competency or tested to see if they're competent to stand trial. So there's a whole range of issues that we need to be looking at and thinking about if we're really going to make this better.
That was To the Point here on KCRW Selects, some of the best episodes from KCRW's award-winning slate of podcasts. And you can find To the Point and all the KCRW podcasts, emotional and hilarious storytelling, fascinating interviews, unforgettable documentaries. And go ahead, subscribe to the ones that you love. It's all at kcrw.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. The music you're listening to is by the Norwegian composer Koda. More information about him can be found on our website. And perhaps the very best way to enjoy KCRW podcasts and programs on the go is the very recently updated KCRW app. Totally redesigned, you can find your stuff easier and make your own favorites and personalized feeds. KCRW Selects was produced with help from Warren Olney, Andrea Brody, Joel Stein, Gary Scott, and Carla Green. Music help from Joe Augustine at Narrative Music. I'm Bob Carlson, and next Friday, after Press Play, we'll highlight another outstanding episode from KCRW's slate of award-winning podcasts. See you then.